Morning. You know, I do want to say that in preparing the sermon this morning, I thought of Doc Hudson a lot, and I know he was a teacher and an educator, and so there are going to be moments where I need you to participate. And if that's uncomfortable, and you feel bad about doing it for me, do it for him. So, and I've tried my best to weave in and out some C.S. Lewis quotes on his behalf, so we can enjoy that with him. So, you know the saying, and we all know this: when life gives you lemons, you what? You make lemonade, right? Doc loves participation, people. But what do you do? And this is the situation that I had. What do you do when life takes the lemon and squeezes the juice into your eyes? That's kind of how my fall has gone. It's one of those moments where you don't really know which way's up type of thing, and you're trying to find your bearing and orient yourself. And I want to give you a quick recap of how that fall went. And so I started a new job. The new job didn't work out as well as I thought it would. I handed my resignation letter, and I joined the ranks of the unemployed, right? Ugh. And I begin what my one friend would dub Monday meltdowns, where every Monday, the weekend is great because everybody's around and doing stuff, and then Monday comes and everybody goes back to work, and you're stuck, you know? You feel like, what am I doing? So I began the Monday meltdowns, and we have a good laugh at that now, but there was a moment when it was like, Monday meltdown. Yeah. So that happens, and within a few weeks, I was coaching the boys' high school soccer team. And here's how our season went. Within a few weeks, the season comes to an end, and we had accumulated the worst record in school history. So as a coach, I'm like, oh my gosh, you can't have that and think, what am I not doing wrong, or what should I have been doing? And you start to question your ability, you start to question who you are. That night, after our season ended, I was so frustrated that we get back from the bus ride, and it's probably 11:30 at night, cold night. And I said to Lauren, I got to go for a walk. I'm going to take my dog because she's my best friend. She's a great listener. She doesn't talk. She just listens, you know. And we're going to go for a walk. We need to clear our heads. And so I put the collar on her. I head on outside, 100 yards outside of our back door. She sees something that looks vaguely familiar to our cat, Mr. Stanley. And she starts to run at it. And before I knew what happened, I see this thing whip around, lift up its tail, and just spray her in the face, right? Yeah, skunk. And she got it in her mouth. She got it in her eyes. It was rough. And so it is 11:30. It's a balmy 38 degrees maybe, like just above freezing, maybe 40. And now I need to wash my dog, so I need to bathe her in our driveway with the hose. 40 degree weather. And so that's going on, and as I am doing this, Lauren comes out and says, hey, I'm looking up information. You're not supposed to put water on it because it's oil and it'll spread the scent around. I said, great, chalk that up. Well, that's another one to the list, right, that I've messed up. And so now we it doubles our effort, and we have to wrap our dog like a mummy, sort of, in blankets, and we duct tape her together and leave her out in the garage for the night. We have pictures for proof. You can ask her for them when you see her. But so that happens. The next day, I say to Lauren, I need to do something right. And she's like, why? Just relax. Like, it'll be okay. And I said, no, you don't understand. I'm a guy. I need to be productive somewhere. Like, I need to do something around the house. And so I said, let me finish raking the leaves. I need to go get the lawnmower fixed because it wasn't picking up leaves. So I said, let me use your car. I'll go take it down to Home Hardware, and I'll come back and I'll clean up the, I'll have the yard ready for winter. Finally, she says, yes, go for it. And so I get her RAV4, which we've just paid off, and I get to drive it maybe once a year. That's the extent of my my privileges with her car. And so I get it, and I load the lawnmower up. I pull out of our driveway. I'm heading down Broad Street, and I hit the brakes a little bit, and I hear the lawnmower roll, and I think, oh no. And then you just hear it, the window shatter. And the handle had busted out the back window, right? And so now I have a lawnmower, and I need to fix this window. And that all happened within 1 week, which is just like, ugh. And finally, I'm in the car with Lauren. This is a couple days later. And she has this beautiful moment of clarity, which I'm very grateful for. It was definitely what I needed to hear. I don't know if it was what I wanted to hear. So let me clarify it with that now. But she says this to me. I'm kind of whining to her and saying, you know, give me attention. I'm being very needy at this point. Affirm me, Lauren. Tell me I'm good. Tell me I'm doing something right. And she says this, Matt, I can't be your God. And then she says, it gets better. She says, I can't give you the applause you're looking for, and it's exhausting for you to expect me to. You're smothering me, and maybe you should go back and review the love that Jesus first offered you. And that was the end of the conversation. And I was like, okay. And so here I am. This is the guy who's hearing this. This is a picture of me. This is a guy. So when I started working for Young Life, I asked Lauren if I could write on our, because we have business cards, but you don't really ever use them within the Young Life context. And so I said, they said, you have to have business cards. And I said, could I get Matt McLean, GSD, gets stuff done. That's what I wanted on my, and it was a joke, but it was like, I pride myself on being a go-getter, on being a busy person, on being able to get things done. And then somewhere underneath all this busyness, all this productivity, this need to perform, is something unhealthy. There's something about needing to contribute, needing to feel like I am contributing something of worth that gives me value. That isn't, it's not the gospel. And so as I'm thinking back through, and I talked to Lauren later, it wasn't so much the paychecks that I missed and having the money that we once did. It was the job, it was the role. It was the sense that I'm giving something and it's of value. And I don't know if any of us have ever had that experience, but this has probably been one of the toughest and yet sweetest sermons that I've ever had to prepare because of that. Because much like Abraham, which we're going to see in a second here, I'm a man in progress. And much like him, I'm learning again and again that the gospel isn't just truth for our heads, it's promise to our hearts. And it's one that can't be repeated too often. And so I'll come back to that story here in a second, but I want to give you a quick snapshot of the man Abraham as it kind of leads into the birth of Isaac, because it's really important that we understand who he was. And, you know, when we first meet him, here's a guy who seems to be pretty confident and capable. And I got to say this, too, because too often we skip over this. Kudos to his wife Sarah, because when God said, here, I'll give you, if you want to follow along, I'll be in Genesis 12. But Genesis 12:1 says this, that when the Lord came and said to Abraham, get up, leave your country, you and your wife, leave your people, leave your father's house, and go to the land I will show you. I mean, he doesn't even give them a destination. He just says, go. We'll figure it out along the way. What kind of people take that risk? And I would argue this, that only self-assured, only strong-willed, only competent people say, yeah, I can handle that kind of adventure. I can handle that kind of risk. And Abraham and Sarah went. And I don't know of many women who have that kind of confidence that they would just get up and go. Leave your family, leave everything that's comfortable, leave it all and go. And yet, at the ripe old age of 75, Abraham and his wife Sarah leave. And on their way out the door, God gives them somewhat of it's a problematic promise. He says this in Genesis 12:2, he says, I will make you a great nation and I will bless you. And I said it was problematic because just a chapter earlier when Moses, who wrote the book of Genesis, is giving us a detailed list of the family tree of Abraham, and he's listing all these names and what they were like, he gives poor Sarah one measly line in this long list. Sarah has this one little snippet, and if you aren't careful, you miss it. And so here it is. Genesis 11, in the midst of Abraham's family tree, it says this, and the name of Abraham's wife was Sarah. And Sarah was childless because she was not able to conceive. And so it's a problem for this couple because in order to be a nation, in order to have a nation, you first have to have what? Children. And so for a couple who's confident enough to go on this journey, who feels capable and self-assured enough in who they are, that they took this risk, embedded within the words of that first promise that we hear God say to them, was the one problem that neither one of them could fix. In fact, it was the one problem that neither one of them wanted to face. And it's the one problem which, if exposed, would render them incompetent, would make them helpless. And when I say that word helpless, there's something in me even that still, it cringes. We don't want to be helpless. To be helpless is to not be in control. To be helpless means that whatever you were doing to conquer, or better yet, quiet that sense of inadequacy, the sense that I need to contribute to what God's doing or before God, it's not working. It means that it's not good enough. It means that even with all of your proficiency, even with all of your effort, that you are still unprepared and unable to answer the big questions in life. In the midst of everything Abraham was and did, and when we look at his life, would do, there's nothing more offensive to hear than the words, you can't. And yet the story of Abraham and the birth of his son Isaac is evidence to the lengths that we as human beings will go to avoid hearing just that diagnosis. And one chapter later, in Genesis 13, after Abraham's plan goes south, physically he goes to Egypt, which is south, and also what must have sounded like a brilliant idea in his head to make his wife Sarah lie to Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, and say, you're my sister, gets them into a royal mess. And Pharaoh actually takes Abraham's wife from him and is getting ready to marry her, to bring her into his harem. And God intervenes, and Abraham is reprimanded by a pagan king. This spiritual giant, Abraham, is being scolded and chided by a pagan king. And this actually happens twice in his life. And so God takes this opportunity of failure to expand on his promise. And he says this in Genesis 13, in verse 16. He says, I will make your offspring like the dust of the earth, so that if anyone could count the dust, then they could count your offspring. Not only is it a nation, now it's as numerous as the dust of the earth. So as if having his doubts and his poor decision-making thrown in his face isn't enough, God puts his thumb right on that sore spot again. Once again, he brings up this promise of children. And again, he brings up the problem of infertility. The promise and the problem. And here's the thing, that in a Near Eastern patriarchal society, having kids was everything. Having somebody to carry on your legacy, to move the family forward, it wasn't just valued. It was everything to them. So to not have kids isn't just embarrassing. It's a source of shame. It's a source of guilt. So why does God keep picking at this wound that should be old? It should be something that Abraham has moved past. Why does God keep picking at it? Because at this point, if I'm Abraham, I can make a very good case that, Lord, I'm in this position. This problem of infertility keeps coming up because you made that stupid promise. You invited me on this challenge. You brought me out here. I'm here because you did this. And God refuses to let up. And two chapters later in Genesis 15, the tension begins to mount, and eventually it boils over. And it almost would appear that God has brought this couple on this adventure to expose them. It feels in some sense cruel. What is he doing? And Abraham finally says this in verse 3 of 15. He says this to God: "You've given me no children, and now a servant in my own household will be my heir." And if you read it starting at verse 1, what starts as a question, "God, will you?" now becomes an accusation. "God, you haven't." Abraham is angry. He's bitter. And if you look back, if I look back on the times in life that we are most angry, it's the times when we are forced to come to this sense that we're inadequate. You stand and you look at a grave and you say, "I can't handle this. Life is too big." You look at a problem like Tuesday, like Doc. Life is too big. I feel inadequate for everything that's been thrown at us. Those are the most painful times in life. And here's the thing. Don't we wear masks of anger just to hide the hurt? And here Abraham is. He's being pushed and pushed and pushed. I feel inadequate. But here's the thing, though. We are so committed to defending our own capabilities, to defending the sense that you say I can't, but I can. I can do this. We are so committed to that we'll do anything to avoid admitting that diagnosis that we can't do it. And in the midst of that, here's the good news. That in Jesus, God doesn't just love us because we are capable, because we're marketable. That's not it. He loves us because that's who he is, period. And this is the only kind of love that you could ever be secure in, because it's the only kind of love you can't lose. And it's when we try to attach conditions to this love that we actually rob it of its beauty. When we try to attach conditions, when we try to make additions, when it becomes Jesus plus my worth, Jesus plus my performance, Jesus plus my job, Jesus plus my security, whenever there's some kind of addition that's put onto that, we begin to dilute the gospel. We begin to strip it of its beauty. And we are so committed to these additions, to these attachments. And the Bible, they operate like functional saviors. And by that I mean this, that while we might claim to know Jesus died as our Savior, and that is enough, that day in and day out, they still hold the keys to our sense of acceptance before God. The Bible also calls them idols. And they are real, not what we profess, but what we practically, day in and day out, they're our gods. When it's Jesus plus comfort, whatever gives you that comfort, you are going to worship. And so we're so committed to performing for these idols that to unearth and remove one, which is what God has done and is doing, is to invite in another, which is what Abraham does. And so while Sarah says this, I can't physically produce an heir with Abraham, they agree on this, that Abraham has compiled enough servants, his wealth is big enough, his servants are numerous enough, that surely he can pick his best and brightest and adopt him as his son. That's the way I can contribute. And at least at that point, God will shut up about kids. And here's how God responds. He says this. Genesis 15, verse 4. No, Abraham, this man will not be your heir. A son who is of your own flesh and blood will be your heir. And he takes him outside and says, Abraham, look up. Look up into the night sky. Look at the stars. And he says, count them if you're able. I love those one-liners. Go ahead and try and count them. Yeah, I put that one there, that one there, that, yep, uh-huh. He says, count them. And then he says this, so shall your offspring be. Again, he expands on the promise. So not only does he cut off Abraham's reasoning and say, no, you're not going to contribute. This is going to be my promise that I carry forward. He repeats and expands on this promise, and in doing so, enlarges the problem. No, Abraham, it won't be a slave. It'll be a son, and it'll be a son that you produce. But how? It's been 10 years. Sarah is still barren. Genesis 16 says this. Sarah says, I have still not given Abraham any children. It's been 10 years since the promise happened. I'm old. I'm past the age when women give birth. That it's physically unhealthy for me to try. And that he says, Sarah and Abraham, this is go-getters. These are people who are self-starters. They're competent. They're creative people used to making things happen. They got stuff done. So when Eliezer, the servant that Abraham wanted to crown as his heir, when God says, no, it's not him, and Eliezer moves out, another idol moves in. Because Sarah says this, it's been 10 years, I haven't given him any kids. While I don't have a son to offer him, I do have this. And she says, in Genesis 16:2, it says, she did have an Egyptian slave named Hagar. And so she did what any barren Near Eastern wife would have done. She offered up her slave, her servant, and said this. She said to Abraham, look, the Lord has kept me from having kids. Go, sleep with my slave instead. Perhaps you can build a family through her. And Abraham agreed. And he slept with Hagar. And she bore him a son. And Abraham gave the name Ishmael to the son that she bore him. And Abraham's prayer to God is this, please, please let Ishmael live before you. Let him be the one that receives your blessing. Let him be the one that your promise comes through. Let me contribute, please. And here's what God says. No. Genesis 17, he says this to Abraham, I have determined to bless Sarah, and you will get your son through her. And at this point, Abraham is beyond frustrated. And it says, when Abraham heard it, he fell on his face and laughed. Have you ever had one of those moments when you're so frustrated? When it is so beyond yourself? When you're so embarrassed, so completely at the end of what you can do that you laugh. And it's not a happy laugh. It's a bitter, resentful, I'm angry laugh. It's the laugh of a man whose identity is being attacked, who feels that his very sense of self is who am I? Am I worth anything? Can I contribute? All that is being assaulted by God's promise. There's a problem that Abraham is unable to contribute to. And so he laughs. And one chapter later, we find Sarah in the same exact position, and her response is the same. Exhausted, embarrassed, she laughs. And God says, Sarah, why did you laugh? Don't you know, is anything too hard for the Lord? I will return to you at the appointed time next year, and Sarah, you will have a son. And by this time, the couple's secret has long gone public. And with each expansion of this promise, the problem grows and grows, and their incompetence becomes more and more apparent to everyone around them. And the inability of their gospel additions, their gospel attachments, the conditions that they put on, it's what God is going to do plus what I can create. The inability of all these things, of all their efforts, becomes more and more undeniable. And you got to think, this already very painful journey, it can't just be coincidence. And that's true for Abraham. That's true for us. This past week, for some of us, has been extremely hard and painful. It can't be coincidence. If God really is God, then he sits on the throne of the entire created universe alone. He doesn't have competition. What he desires to do, when he desires to do it, it happens. Things like chance, coincidence, mistakes, in God's world, they don't exist. That means that God doesn't just predict the future, he creates it. He authors it. None of his plans are frustrated. None of his purposes are held up. It means that when an aged man whose name means father of many has to constantly explain to people why he still doesn't have kids, that it's not just some cruel twist of blind fate. That it's intentional. That our lives, when we fail to learn the lessons we need to, they don't just make big repeating circles. That we don't end right back where we started, spinning our wheels. That even then, when it feels like we're doing this, that our lives, they have direction. That our pain, it has purpose. It means that God didn't just predict Sarah's barrenness. He ordained it. He designed it. That he knew exactly what he was doing when he took one of the most capable, competent couples in the world and gave them a promise beyond their wildest dreams and a problem beyond any of their abilities. And God gives them the space to try all of these functional saviors, to spin all of their wheels and try everything that they can and try to create as much help that they think that God needs. And then he finally brings them to this place. And the buildup that Isaac has to his birth is unmatched in the Old Testament. Never before and never since in the whole Old Testament do we have a birth so talked about before it actually happens. There was so much buildup that when you finally read it, if you're not watching, it almost sounds mundane. It just kind of happens. But listen to the words. When he finally arrives, and this is the verse that Peggy read, in Genesis 21. Now the Lord was gracious to Sarah and visited her just as he said he would. And the Lord did for Sarah just what he had promised. And Sarah became pregnant and bore a son to Abraham in his old age. at the exact time that God had promised them. And Abraham gave the name Isaac to the son Sarah bore him. And when his son Isaac was 8 days old, Abraham circumcised him, just as God commanded. Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born. And Sarah said, God has brought me laughter, and everyone who hears about this will laugh with me. And she added, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children, and yet I have borne him a son in his old age? Just as he has said, exactly what he had promised, at the exact time that God told them. I want your eyes to rest on this. It's the word gracious there at the beginning. You know, a couple weeks ago, Mike gave us a great definition of the word grace. He said it is the unearned, unsought, undeserved blessing of God. So by definition, grace is not something that you go and find. It's not something that you go and secure. It's something that comes and finds you, or rather someone. And in the story of Abraham and the birth of his son Isaac, we see the commitment of a man and woman who are willing to do anything and everything to avoid hearing this diagnosis of you can't. To avoid hearing that you are incompetent, that you are unable. And yet, in all that commitment, in all that busyness, it is overshadowed by the commitment of another, the determination of someone else. Because we hear and see God say this, Abraham, no, stop. Abraham, I am eternally, doggedly committed to this, that you have no other gods before me and no props, no idols, no additions, no attachments beside me. It's me, me alone. He says, I'm committed to this, that you will not cheapen my love for you by confusing it with a love that you can lose, with a love that somehow you work to secure and that you have to work to somehow keep. Don't confuse my love with that. I'm committed to this, that you will not rob yourself of that kind of freedom, of that kind of joy. As C.S. Lewis said, you do not yet look as happy as I intend for you to be. Abraham, this is the love you were made for, the love you've been looking for your whole life. This is it. And here's the good news, this is where it hit me. Because if I needed to hear anything this fall, it was this, that stop trying to earn it. I have called you my son, and I accept you and love you and applaud you. And that does not change depending on your performance. Here's the good news, that this is a love which refuses to be watered down. That it's a love which won't settle for anything less than your full and final enjoyment of its infinite depths and immeasurable heights. That it's a love which pours down through the corridors of history like a flood, and it claims victim after victim. Abraham, Isaac, Sarah, Jacob, Joseph. And yet, as it rolls, a better and clearer and fuller picture of God's commitment to this kind of love, to us enjoying this love, begins to show up on the horizon. And I said that Isaac's birth was the most talked about, anticipated birth in the entire Old Testament. Well, there is another birth in the New Testament, which for centuries had been anticipated. And the buildup to it was unlike any other. And it made Isaac look small. This baby. It says this in Luke, that one day God sent an angel to angel named Gabriel to a town in Galilee to announce yet again another miraculous birth to a virgin engaged to a man named Joseph, who was a descendant of David, who was a descendant of Abraham, a descendant of Isaac. The virgin's name was Mary. The angel found her and said, "Greetings, you who are blessed. The Lord is with you." Notice the angel found her. God went and found Abraham. The angel went and found Mary. She's a virgin. Sarah was barren. Impossible. Mary was troubled at his words and wondered what kind of greeting this could be, but the angel said to her, "Mary, do not be afraid. Grace has found you. You will conceive and give birth to a son, and you are to call him Jesus. And he will be great and will be called the Son of the Most High. And as for his kingdom, it will never end." And Mary says this, which sounds exactly like Sarah. "How will this be?" Mary asked the angel, "Since I'm a virgin, it's impossible. How can this happen?" The angel answered, "The Holy Spirit will overshadow you. For with God, nothing is impossible. Is anything too hard for the Lord? And no word from God will ever fail. And in his life and death, in the life and death of this baby, this Jesus, we are shown like never before the unyielding commitment of man to cling to his own sense of competence, the sense that I can, I need to. We see that in a way like never before, that man is committed to this. And yet, his commitment is overshadowed by another. Because we see the undying, the relentless commitment of a God whose love refuses to let us go. Would you take a moment just to consider, and this is a C.S. Lewis quote from Doc. I'm sure he's going to appreciate this. "The unblushing promises and the staggering nature of that which is held out to us in the gospel." Would you take a moment just to consider that, and I'll close us in prayer in a second. Let's pray. God, would you use the life of Abraham and the birth of his son Isaac as a mirror into our own souls? God, would those of us who've been claimed and called by this love, would we find rest in its persistence, in its hold on us? God, would we celebrate the unfiltered and unrestrained joy that Doc Hudson now feasts on, that even death is subject to your plans, and that you have transformed one of our greatest enemies, the one thing that we can't control, into the place where we most abrasively feel the grip of your grace on us. God, would we look forward to that? And will we know that Doc enjoys that even now? And God, may those of us who've never encountered you, would you give us eyes to see us as we really are? And would you make your beauty and your goodness seen even in the midst of hearing those words, "You can't"? And Jesus, we pray that the God of Abraham, the God of Sarah, the God of Isaac, that would be our God. that would be the God who has Doc, that would be the God who has us, that would be the God that has me. God, we praise the love that won't let go. May we find rest in the midst of heartache. Would we find joy in the midst of pain? And all God's people said, amen.